Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to episode 91 of Trundle Bed Tales. And today we're going to be talking Carrie Ingalls Swainsey. But before we get started on that, let's have a little housekeeping.
But if you hear that sound, which is the noise made by washing metal plates in a metal wash tub on the stove, then you know it's time for a little housekeeping. And here on Trundle Bed Tales, our housekeeping means giving you the information you may need about the show. If you ever want to listen to an episode live, but you don't want to just stream it through the computer, you can call in at 714-242-5253. That's 714-242-5253. Or toll free 1-877-633-9389. That's toll free 1-877-633-9389. You can also use those same numbers to call in and ask a question and otherwise be on the show. Just make sure that you hit 1 when they ask you to, so the little symbol comes up and I know you have a question so that you want to talk. Anytime you're streaming an episode, you can also join in the chat room. Unless there's some technical issue, I always open it up. You'll find you have the easiest time accessing the chat room if you log in, either using your Facebook login or if you go ahead and create a Blog Talk Radio account. The account is free and makes it easier to do several things, including sign up to follow shows and get an email anytime a new episode is scheduled or is archived and you can listen to the stream. If you enjoy Trundle Bed Tales, then you can find us many other places around the web as well. Besides appearing on the podcast, there's also a Trundle Bed Tales YouTube channel that has both travel diaries and short films about things related to Laura, like a video of what it's like to wade in Plum Creek and one of Shirley Knockmoose ringing the church bell, that's right, pause bell, in Walnut Grove. You can also find our page on Facebook and like it, our Twitter account, and I also have a Laura Ingalls Wilder interest group on LinkedIn, and you can find us there too. So there's always more Laura things to talk about.
All right, thanks.
I hope you enjoy the show and that you will take the time to comment, to like our pages, and to let us know what it is you like or don't about the show.
And that was it for our housekeeping today. And it's really going to be, I hope, a special episode because in the world of Little House and Laura fandom, for a lot of times what we get is people talking about Laura's point of view. But today we're going to have someone talking about Carrie. And Jeannie, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Sarah. How are you?
Yay. Feeling much better now I got a hold of you. I don't know what's going on with this system. It just does not want to call out sometimes.
Well, you know, I live in a very small town, and, you know, maybe our hamster has fallen off the wheel for technology here, so.
Well, that's probably Blog Talk, but they have this nice feature that we can call out and do a podcast live, which I like, so we put up with it. So, Jeannie, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Okay. My name is Jeannie Kirkpatrick, and I am the museum director / curator at the Keystone Historical Museum here in Keystone, South Dakota. For those of you who don't know where Keystone, South Dakota is, we're basically at the base of Mount Rushmore. I'm proud to say that I am from Iowa.
Yay!
Actually, Iowa State University. There are myself and another museum director who is also from Iowa State University that, you know, Sarah, you have interviewed. So that's kind of neat that all of us Iowans have that Ingalls connection.
Well, you know, Tim Sullivan and his family at the Ingalls Homestead are also from Iowa. It just goes to prove all the best people are from Iowa, I always say.
That's right.
Though that may not be a popular opinion in South Dakota.
Yeah. But they let me live here and stuff, so.
So that's good.
Yeah. So when I'm not here as being a museum director, I am a park ranger up at Mount Rushmore. So some people say I have the best of both worlds here. And what is neat is both of them have an Ingalls connection. So I am just surrounded by Ingalls.
Well, I think that's a good thing. And I think that the Keystone Museum is lucky to have, you know, somebody with a professional viewpoint coming in, and I think it can only mean good things coming forward.
Yeah. Speaking of good things, yesterday we had over, I want to thank all the Ingalls fans out there. Yesterday we had 101 people come and visit us, and we are going to be close to either tying that record today or breaking it. So I do have to say thank you, Ingalls fans, for seeking us out and coming and visiting us.
Well, I'm glad to hear you're getting good numbers.
Yeah, we are too. It just shows you that you never know what you're going to find in a small town.
That is certainly true. And it really, I don't think I have this on my questions later on, but I have to say that Keystone, one of the things that impressed me when I visited for the first time in many years was how many signs and things they had directing to the museum. And when I was going around with my Laura t-shirt, how many people told me I needed to go to the museum, which is all really great to have that kind of support from the community.
Yeah, they are very proud of the Ingalls connection here, and they are proud of the old schoolhouse here that the collection is housed in, along with other collections. And once they spot that, they'll point you in the right direction. They're very friendly here. Almost, I think, they may have beaten us Iowa people in Iowa Nice here in South Dakota. So yeah, they're very helpful, and they're proud.
Now, let's kind of start switching gears over to Carrie. Now,
yep.
So she had lived quite a bit of her life before she came to Keystone, but most people don't know much about her sort of after the books end. And if they do, they know a little bit about her as a newspaper woman. So why don't you kind of clue us in on a little bit of her life before she got to Keystone that you've been learning about?
Sure. So, you know, as any good Ingalls fan knows, that Carrie graduated from DeSmit. And after that, in 1889, then she apprenticed with Carter Sherwood, and she was there for 15 years. And I don't know what possessed her or made her, maybe she had a little bit of paws, itchy feet, but she decided to put her name in a lottery for a homestead claim. And this was in 1906. And this was also near, it was at Top Bar, which is near present day Phillips, South Dakota now. And she was a mighty woman. So she did that for 2 years off and on. So in the good weather. She would stay at her claim, and then she would go back home and be with Mary and Ma and Pa and Dismit. That was after Pa passed away, but she would go back home to Dismit. And some things are, I'm still learning about Carrie in her life, but in 1908, she answered a help wanted ad from S.L. Sin, and he figured out, he was a newspaper man, and he had an understanding that when you own a mine, you have to put an ad in the paper twice to see if someone else has the rights to it. And so he's kind of been known as the final proof king. And what he did was he hired a lot of females. And there was two requirements for the women that he hired. One requirement was they had to be a temperist, and the other one, he had to be a staunch Republican. Well, Carrie was in the temperist movement, not so much maybe that staunch Republican, but she managed. And so she worked for various newspapers, and what she was hired to do was to establish and manage these newspapers. So sometimes she would be put in a place where a newspaper was kind of failing, either be it the town was dwindling or there just wasn't much news. And she actually had a really good skill of making those newspapers blossom again. She, in 1910, she managed the paper in Roseland, South Dakota. In 1911, she came to Keystone and also worked at the Rapid City paper. And then in 1912, she got transferred over to the Hill City, Hill City Star. And Hill City is about 15 minutes away here from Keystone. And that is where she met her future husband, David Swansea. And at that time, when she was running the Hill City Star, she was 40, in her early 40s, 40, 41. And so, you know, as Laura had written about Carrie being so sickly in her books, Carrie just moved around a lot, and she seemed like she was a tough woman to homestead by herself out there. For a few years, and then to work basically in what some people might say in a man's world.
She got older. Carrie seemed to get tougher. I think that there were some health issues when she was younger, probably coming out of malnutrition, but she does seem to have rebounded and done really well in her later life.
Yeah. Yeah, I think she did too. She did go to Colorado during some time in that time period in there because of her asthma, and didn't last long, so the climate must not have been good for her. It seemed like Keystone must have been the best environment for her asthma. We have nothing recorded of her asthma ever flaring back up here in any of the records that we have. So that's kind of nice to know that this temperature and climate was good for her.
Yes, it is. So we got Carrie to Hill City. How did she get to Keystone?
So after 1910, when she was done with Roseland, then Sin would send her to Keystone, for the Keystone Recorder was kind of failing. The Holy Terror Mine had stopped producing. It was taking a lot of lives. There was a lot of lawsuits. And the town was dwindling in population. So I believe that because of that, then Sin had bought that newspaper and put Carrie in there to go ahead and get the readership back up for him. And it didn't take her long to do this. She was quite a good businesswoman.
Well, that's good to hear. I mean, a lot of times people talk about that, you know, she'd written or they weren't quite sure what she was doing, but that she was actually considered a good businesswoman in Keystone. That I'm glad to know that.
Yeah, she was also known as a very good pillar of the community, too. She did a lot of good things here in Keystone for the community that some of the residents still talk about to this day. We have a few residents that are still alive that knew Carrie when they were quite small. So.
Okay, well, let's kind of broaden out here for a minute and tell us a little bit about the town of Keystone. If people haven't been there, kind of how it's situated and just sort of its general background.
Sure. So a lot of people think that the town of Keystone became about because of Mount Rushmore, and then I have to tell people that is false. The town of Keystone was a mining community. Actually, it came around a little later than some of the other communities that are around here. So the town was not established until 1891, and it was because of three miners that ran the Holy Terror Mine. And they named it, one of them was from back east, and his home state nickname was Keystone. And also, if you look on the map, Keystone is kind of like in the center of everything in this area. So they say it's kind of the Keystone of everything. So mining was really good at first when the town was founded. And then in the early 1900s, the biggest mine, Holy Terror Mine, was starting to take workers' lives. And back then there was no OSHA, no regulations. And so people started suing. And so the mining company shut it down because of all the lawsuits. They lost money, could not produce as well. There was several smaller mines in the area. Some of these produced gold, others produced minerals. And so there for a while, Keystone kind of went into an economic slump. And it wasn't until the time of the carving of Mount Rushmore in 1924, Mount Rushmore was started in 1927, that things started to pick up again for Keystone. And then really picked up with the carving of Mount Rushmore, really helped that out. And so during this whole time, from 1911, 1912, Carrie was in this. And so she saw the ups and downs of this community. There was several natural disasters during this time. And, you know, people were very hard workers. They only had electricity for certain hours of the day. And they did not get full electricity here in Keystone until 1928. So can you imagine, you know, you wanted to wash your clothes. You could only do it usually they did it here in Keystone on Mondays. Because the guy knew that they needed to pump a little bit more juice in the generator for those women to use their wash machines and stuff. And then as Mount Rushmore progressed, then Keystone turned into more of a tourism town. And where we're kind of, now Keystone is kind of divided into what we call Old Keystone, where the museum is located, and New Keystone, where Carrie's house used to be. And that is more what we call on the strip, more the souvenir shops and restaurants and hotels and stuff like that. And but we still try to find that balance between old and new and embrace our history here in Keystone. And for some of you out there listening from bigger cities, the number I'm going to tell you is correct. So our population in Keystone right now is 331 people, which makes living here very interesting, and especially in the winter time when our tourist season is not as strong, we do other things, things that probably Carrie would appreciate because it benefits the children here. So we have roller skating and we have bingo. So we have this progression where at one time when the mining was good that we were busy. Keystone was bigger than Rapid City, and that was anywhere from a 2,000 to 3,000 population. And now Rapid City has about 73,000 people. So we have seen a lot of ups and downs here in Keystone throughout the years.
Well, I'm surprised the population is that low. I mean, the town where I work in the public library is about twice that. And having looked at that town and looking at yours, I'd have said yours was a lot bigger.
Yeah, we hide things well. We actually have to bring in workers from other countries, student workers from other countries. People will come in from other places. We have our camper workers that will come in. They live in their RVs, and they'll come on and work. And so that kind of gives you the false sense of how many people actually live here in Keystone. And plus, we're also kind of spread out between that old and new Keystone. And so it kind of, you know, gives you a false pretense of how big we really are.
Okay, well, let's talk specifically about David Swainsey and what was his background and who was he in town?
Sure. So David Swainsey came out this way, and I'm not sure the date. We are finding some dates that are misleading, and so we're doing some research currently on that. So David Swainsey actually was from a very wealthy family from St. Louis, and he came out this way as a salesman, and he actually liked it out here, and he told his parents that he was decided to stay out here. And at that time, we are not sure if he was married to his wife. We do know that she is from Illinois, and so we are not sure when she comes into the picture. And so then also David, during this time when he was out here, he decided to go back to school, back to this School of Mines, and get a geology degree. And so he was a geologist around here, and he was a miner. He also worked for the railroad. He was a superintendent of the school, and he just did a little bit of everything if it kind of like produced money. And he was a well-respected man in the community. He is actually listed as one of the founding families here in Keystone, along with a few others. And so his first wife, Elizabeth, and their two children, we believe that Harold was born out here. We know Mary was born back in Illinois. And but David was, like I said, very respected. He was very respected until the time he passed away. He worked up until the day he died. And as I was getting ready for this interview, I was looking at all the different mines that he owned. And he did not own, he owned a few of them total outright, and then a few of them he was in business with other people or owned a percentage of the mines. And so there are two mines that he owned outright, and then there are five mines that he had three-fourths of interest in, and one is listed as part, And those are patent mining claims. And I need to take a mining 101 class. So those patent mining claims, that means that they have been, there's a patent, there's paperwork. But then he had very many unpatent mining claims. He had 25 unpatent mining claims. There was 23 of those mining claims he had 1/6 of an interest in. And two of them he had, it looks like, outright unpatent mining claims. So he was the go-to man for geology or anything at that time to do with mining. We do recently have discovered a picture of him and his classmates at the School of Mines, about 1895 picture. And so that was kind of neat. And he still has his, for those of you who have seen a picture of David Swansea, he's always sporting that, his stylish mustache. And even back in college, he had that sporting mustache. So he did not come up with very many good names on those mines. He had one mine called Elkhorn, and he had several of those mines, and then they would just name him number 2, number 3, number 4, number 7, number 8. He did the same thing with a mine called Rosebud, named it 1 through 9, so it was interesting. As we're doing the research with David's mining claims, is that he had at one time a very famous, we believe, an interesting mining partner. And we're not sure if it's the Thomas A. Edison, but so it is in there that with this group of people, and it was interesting that they only list this Thomas A. Edison. So it would have been the time period that Thomas Edison was alive, and so possibly could have been one of David Swansea's partners in one of the mining.
You'll have to check with the Edison House, see if they have anything on it.
Yeah, I'm going to, and things like that. And it came from those, I believe those papers that we just recently have obtained. And so, yeah.
Before we move on from his mines, I think most people, when they're thinking mine, think gold mine, but there's more kinds of mines than that. What kind of mines did he have?
I'm not really sure. We have some mica mines here. Mica sometimes were used for the glass and stoves and stuff like that. And so that's something that we need to be researching and probably will be our winter project. A lot of these mines for him, some of them kept their names throughout different ownership, and some of these mines have changed hands and then changed names. So we have to do that tracing of the mines and stuff, and that can be it's almost like genealogy. It could be a long process of figuring out these mines. But I know the minerals around here, most of the minerals that you will find in your pyrite dishes. So besides gold mines, it could be mica, anything that, you know, makes those pyrite dishes and stuff like that. So it was, it's interesting. And like I said, we got a lot of research ahead of us. And I need to take my mining 101 class. I have to go to the School of Mines and take a class now with this position. So, and when I do find out, Sarah, I'll let you and your listeners know.
Well, I'd appreciate that. Now, the other thing that people, Laura fans anyway, really know about David Swansea is the story that he was involved with naming Mount Rushmore. And he actually was, I think. Is that right?
Well, we're not really sure. He was with the party. So in 1885, there was an attorney named Charles E. Rushmore. He was out here for another mining company to see who owned what land. And so first thing they had to teach Mr. Rushmore was how to ride a horse, because he was from New York. They had streetcars back then, or you walked. So they taught him how to ride a horse, and they take him out to the mine where the possible mining company wants him to look at the land. And so he was also there with Bill Challis. And so, you know, Mr. Rushmore is, like, pointing at everything. You know, he's from a big city. He's never been out here, open country, all the, you know, mountains, mountain peaks. And so he's, like, just pointing away and just saying, what's his name, what's his name, and what's his name? So when they get to the place where Mount Rushmore is today, it never had a name. So the locals would call it Cougar Mountain, Sugarloaf, just various different names, but nothing that really stuck. And so one of the guys, and I'm not sure if it was Bill Challis or David Swansea, said, you know what? We'll name it after you. We'll name it Mount Rushmore. So after they're done, Charles Rushmore comes down into Keystone, goes to a restaurant and bar, and says, guess what? I just got this mountain named after me. And when Guts and Borglum came about and found the mountain where he wanted to carve Mount Rushmore, he never changed the name. And in the 1930s, the geology department, U.S. Geology, registered the mountain's name as Mount Rushmore. So we're really not sure which one, but he was there with the party with the naming of Mount Rushmore, and it has been said that he was also with Guts and Borglum when Guts and Borglum was looking for a place to carve Mount Rushmore. He wanted a geologist, and David came to mind, somebody's mind, and so he went out with Guts and Borglum. So he's been kind of famous twice.
Yes. I think that's a great story. It's always nice when the Ingalls story kind of works into some other big historic thing. So I think that's really cool.
Yeah, I think so too.
All right. Now, the other thing that kind of sets Carrie apart from her sisters is that she was, along with Laura, the only ones to have any children. But Carrie's are stepchildren, and why don't you tell us a little bit about them?
Sure. So David loses his first wife, Elizabeth, during childbirth of their third child. And David, for a couple of years, was a widower, and the kids become sick. And Carrie kind of nursed the kids back to health, and they kind of, a romance kind of blossomed. And right 2 days before Carrie's 42nd birthday, Carrie and David got married. So Carrie became stepmom to daughter Mary and son Harold. And because of the scarlet fever, Harold was almost completely deaf as an after effect of the scarlet fever. And because Harold was so young when his mother died, to him, Carrie is the only mom he remembers. And the school that the museum is housed in is the school that Mary and Harold went to. Even though Harold was almost completely deaf, he was able to read lips, and so he was able to stay in a mainstream school room. And because of these two children that Carrie has, she doted on other children. She loved kids. So she would also throw Harold and Mary's friends parties here in the school. And Harold grows up to be a very nice young man. He actually was one of the workers at Mount Rushmore, carving Mount Rushmore, up until about 1938. He was killed, and his friend was killed in an auto accident. His sister and Carrie took that very, very hard. Harold's death, 1939. took that death very, very hard. The family, I got to meet some of the family last year. They still come to this area to have their family reunions. And so they came to me and they told me that Harold was engaged to be married, and he went over to Hill City to talk to his sister, who was very pregnant at the time, to see if she would be the maid of honor. And she had to decline because she was very far along in her pregnancy. And on the way back, the two young men were in a car accident, and the windshield decapitated both of them. And Carrie, like I said, Carrie took it very hard. Mary went on to get married in 1921 and started giving Carrie and David grandchildren in 1923, and that ended up having 14 kids. There was two kids that did not make it out of infancy and one young child that didn't make it out of the toddler years and passed away. The rest of them have made it through adulthood now. Some of them have deceased. But Mary was a pillar of the community. Her and her husband moved over to Hill City, and many of the students that went to Keystone then went on over to Hill City for the rest of high school, and they remember Mary being their lunch lady and have very fond memories of Mary always being sweet and very nice and caring. Traits I believe that she probably got from her first mother. She was a little older and she remembers her, and also traits that she got from Carrie. Sad to say, Mary passed away in 1969, but she lived a nice long life and treated others with respect.
So it's kind of ironic because the Ingalls family, you know, started out with five kids, and then they didn't end up with any biological grandchildren, but they ended up with so many from Mary having so many kids.
Yeah, and they do, and they speak highly of the older grandkids that remember Carrie. They speak very highly of Carrie. The younger ones, the ones that were born in the 1940s, they kind of don't remember Carrie because they were so young. And they also actually, there's a rumor, but there's a story going around in the family that Carrie actually adopted the kids, because at that time, if you just placed an ad in a paper, then it was legal. And that's something else I need to search about. But the rest of them have fond memories of Carrie, and they do pass those down to the next generation. So now I'm meeting great grandkids and great nieces and nephews and large families. And they have their family reunion in this area, and they always stop here to look at Carrie's objects and her stuff and to share such good memories that they have of her.
Well, that's really great. One of the things that I found interesting when I visited Keystone this time is I hadn't realized kind of how many times Keystone was sort of destroyed and a lot of records lost. So why don't you tell us about the fires and floods?
Yes, so we are sad to say, you know, we know that Carrie worked for the Keystone Recorder. We do not have any papers at this museum because of the many fires and floods that we have had here. We have had more fires in Keystone than we have had floods. So I'll start with the fires first. At one time, what we call Old Keystone was the whole area of Keystone, and it just took out one whole section of Keystone in the early 19 teens. I want to say the 1917 fire. It just took out businesses and just one whole side of the street. Luckily, we have not had a lot of deaths because of the fires. And so we have lost a lot of our records here in Keystone. There has been a few fires where the Freemasons and the Eastern Star were involved. And because their secretary and their treasurer, for some odd reason, had those books with them at home, some of those records have survived. So we kind of have to piece together our history here in Keystone. And the last really big major fire here in Keystone was in 1937. And because of that outcome then became the Volunteer Fire Department. Before that, they really didn't have a way to put out the fires. Sometimes it was the bucket line, basically like they did on the prairie. You created a bucket, you found the creek, and you did a bucket line. One of the fires that happened in the 1970s was kind of sad. It was in 1977, and it involved Carrie's house. A young worker who was 16 was downstairs cleaning some equipment, and the chemical she had on a rag, she just threw down, I'm sure many other times before, and then the water heater kicked on and created an explosion. And so she lost her life, and then the 12-year-old worker that was upstairs, she became injured, but because of one of the locals and the volunteer fire department, it ended up being a total loss. But at least one life was saved with that. Now I'm proud to say that Keystone has a full-time fire department, and we basically have stopped having fires. Sometimes so not so much for floods. And so some of the floods happened when David was around and was working with the railroad system, and we have a picture in our historical photo room showing David running from his little office from the railroad with the records, and you could just see the water that's under his feet and probably comes up to his shins, and he's trying to preserve some history. So we've had only three major floods. We've had one in 1929, a 1933, and then the one in 1972 where over 200 people between Rapid City and Keystone lost their lives, and the majority of those people were visitors to the area at that time. And yeah. Carrie's house did survive the 72 flood because it was a little elevated, but not the 5 years later with the 77 fire. So we have, like I said, lost a lot of our history. We would love if you have a reader that is listening and has a newspaper, a Keystone Recorder newspaper from 1911, we would love to have a copy of that here in our museum. So it's our little connection to Cary. So it's not even the State Historical Society has any of these papers on because of all the natural disasters we have had. So they can't even help us out, and we try to help them out and stuff.
Yeah, I going back this last time, I don't remember anything really about it when I was a kid, but you heard in quite a few times people still talking about the 72 flood, which I thought was interesting because the 2008 flood in Cedar Rapids was so bad, and before we had the one that wasn't quite so bad last year, you know, kids had no idea about it, but people were still talking about the 72 flood, even this last year.
Yeah, and visitors, when they come, we have a room, a historical photo room, and so we have one side that is our fires, and we have one side with a lot of information from the 72 flood. It's sad to say that there are still people missing from the 72 flood that may never be found. They tried their best. A lot of people were camping by the creek because it was, you know, you had a water source and stuff like that. But when the dam broke in Rapid, it happened at about 9 o'clock at night. So, and by then there was really no tornado sirens or no warning system to let people know what was going on. And it was dark and you just heard this rush of water, and people have said that they would just hear, you couldn't see that they lost electricity, so everything was dark, but you would just hear people just yell and just help me, and they would be, even be in RVs, and you would hear them, the RV going down, and just, yeah, it was, it shut Keystone down for quite some time. The only people that could get in was the National Guards, because all the bridges that Keystone has, they were wiped out due to that flood that night.
Well, before we move on from natural disasters, where exactly was Carrie's house? So if people want to see the site, where is it?
Sure. So if when you're on what we call the Strip in Keystone, and you'll know you're there on the Strip, that's where all of the, it's all also known as Winter Street. That's also where all the souvenir shops are. So if you find the taffy shop, and next to the taffy shop, going west is the Black Hills Souvenir Shop. And right in that area is where Carrie's house was. And the lady, LaVita, who owns the Black Hills Souvenir Shop, has Carrie's name on her deed to her business. And LaVita remembers Carrie when she was a little girl. So it's kind of bittersweet for LaVita, because LaVita went to the school here in Keystone. She knew Carrie, and now she has part of Carrie's land.
Well, that is nice. And that was something I really enjoyed doing, was being able to figure out where Carrie's house was, because you always hear about it, and to actually be able to find the spot, even though the house is gone, I really enjoyed that. So I was glad that I got to do that, and I recommend anybody going to Keystone take that a little extra time to look for Carrie's house.
Yeah, and we'll help you. You know, if you stop and ask, you know, like Sarah said, wear your Englisher, people will point you into the right direction. And if you start at our post office, and it's marked post office, and there's a little little sign there that talks to you about the Ingles, you're on the same side of the street. You just need to walk up the street west as you're going toward the Mount Rushmore, and there'll be other signs, and then there's a sign in that area where Carrie's house was, and a picture of what her house used to look like.
So we might have, we've got about 10 minutes, which I can't believe it's gone that fast. You may have to have you back after you've done some more research on Carrie to talk about her life in Keystone. But I want to skip ahead to make sure we get to this stuff. What happened
sure.
to Carrie's stuff when she passed on?
What? That is a really good question, because by that time, it's only Carrie and Laura that are living, and her stepdaughter, Mary. Carrie last saw Laura in 1944, and she seemed to be in good health during that visit down to Mansfield. And so between 1944 and 1946, her health, kind of Carrie's health, started deteriorating. And so she gives a letter to a really good friend and former teacher here. And in that, she bequeathed all her personal belongings to Wilmetta Johnson. And so Wilmetta and her husband, A.I. Johnson, were really good friends of the Swanseys for many, many years. Wilmetta actually taught under David, being the superintendent of the schools here, and that's how long they've known each other. And so when the time came and Carrie had to go to the hospital and passes away in the hospital, Wilmetta then, after the will is read, then she has Carrie's stuff. And So she has Carrie's jewelry. She has a glove box. She also has some other personal Ingalls stuff in her collection. And some of this stuff Wilma does not realize what she has for many years. Now, Carrie passes away in 1946, and it wasn't until 1983 that Wilmetta, A.I. Johnson, and a few other residents of Keystone puts the Keystone Area Historical Society together. And they started out with just the Carrie collection. And one of the things that Wilmetta did not realize that she had for many years, because it was wrapped in a blanket. But Sarah, right before we came on the air, like an hour before, it actually was wrapped in an old pillowcase. I got a list of all of Carrie's items just like an hour before we started here.
Cool.
And so the thing that was wrapped in the pillowcase, we believe, all evidence points, that is Ma's China Shepherdess. And it was, Wilmetta just didn't realize that she had that. And so that's kind of one of our really cool prized possessions that Carrie has left us. There's also, for me, I'm not a big coffee drinker. But Carrie even left us her everyday coffee cup, stains and all. So those are two of the things I'm proud of. Besides, I'm proud of all of it. But those are two of the interesting things that we have here. And that's how we obtained her stuff. We also obtained a few stuff through Bill Anderson. But the majority of the stuff came personally through Carrie. She gave her sister Laura nothing. We recently got a kind of a copy of her will after her will has been read. And she left Laura nothing. She was going to leave Grace something, but Grace had passed on by then. And then she left her stepdaughter $100. Carrie was a generous woman. She was also an Eastern Star, member of the Eastern Star. And she left the Masons her homestead claim and some land of David's here in Keystone so the Masons can have a permanent lodge. And she felt if the Masons would always take care of the Stars. That's her quote.
Well, that's a really neat thing. And I'm sorry we're having to kind of rush here at the end, because I also wanted to talk about Mary and how she was there the last few years. But considering how much time we have left, we'll have to maybe put you on the agenda to come back next year. And hopefully you've gotten some more research and can tell us some more stuff. But before that, just quickly, will you tell us where exactly people can find the Keystone Area Historical Society? Where is it located in town?
Sure. We are at 410 3rd Street. We are up on the hill. We are the old three-story Victorian schoolhouse. We are also online, keystonehistory.com, and we are also on Facebook, Keystone Historical Museum. And so those are the three places. So if you can't make it, you can go to our Facebook page or you could go to our website. But we would love to have you stop on and see us. We're only open until September 15th. We are a seasonal museum, and we'll be open again on May 1st of next year.
Okay, that is actually, I think, a little longer than it's been the last while, so I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, and with us having more and more visitors, I think we're going to extend. We're going to try. Anybody out there, if you're going to come this way for spring break, I believe we're going to try to be open on the weekends for spring break up here. So, yeah, something different. So we'll probably start the second weekend in March. So, yeah, dress warm. We have no heat. So,
Well, I'll have to get the details for that from you for my home site's opening things later. Among the display, you have things from at least something from pretty much every Ingalls family member, which is cool. And you've been doing a lot of work on sort of rearranging things and coming up with projects. And your main project now, I think, is a fundraiser to get new windows for the building. So how is that going?
That is going. We still have $300. And so we did a GoFundMe account. And so the museum was built in 1899, and we believe we have original windows. And so it's also one way for us, we need to get these windows redone, and so we could help protect our artifacts here a little bit more. We're going to start on one side of the building where there is a sidewalk for our, it's two local gentlemen that have been taught how to do restoration in historical buildings. And then they're going to work. Then they're going to work their way over into the Ingalls room because that is just a sheer drop off on the side. So they'll have to use scaffolding. So we're always still looking for funds. Our GoFundMe account is out there for our windows. Anything that can help, even sharing it. If you can't donate, even sharing it with someone or putting it on your Facebook page or letting people know, that will just help us out tremendously.
And every year you do have an event for Carrie Ingalls' birthday, which is awesome because it's right near my birthday, so I need to come out sometime. But is it still on the actual 3rd no matter what? Because I know for many years it was that way.
No. So this year it is on her birthday. So next Thursday, August 3rd, from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., we will be celebrating Carrie's birthday. She loved parties, and so we still do that, her 147th. We actually will move it around due to the Sturgis Motorcycle Rally. Nothing against the Sturgis Motorcycle Rally, but a lot of families do not come out during that time period, so it's easier. So in 2020, when Carrie turns 150, we have to celebrate in July because Sturgis is having their 80th anniversary. So, but this year, I am trying to connect Carrie and Sturgis for our Facebook post for the week. So I think that's going to be like something fun to do. So we have to occasionally move her birthday around. It's about every 5th year we have to do that. And we try to let people know ahead of time, put it on our Facebook and our website.
Okay. Well, we have about 3 minutes, which is, 2 minutes. And I know there was a lot of stuff that we were hoping to get to that we didn't, but is there anything important that you want to make sure we get in this episode?
So I've been working on Carrie's birthday, and we just recently have found a lot of Carrie's handwriting, which you didn't get to see when you were here because I just found it. So the Eastern Star of Keystone are no longer with us. They are a chapter over in Hermosa town next to us. As I call them, our neighbors down the street. And so they're starting to give me their records. And Carrie was the secretary for many years. And so I've just come upon her handwriting and stuff, and it was gorgeous. Her handwriting was just gorgeous and perfect. And I'll probably put a sample of that on our Facebook page here soon, but it was just neat to see her handwriting and see her signature, and it's just, I feel like I've got to know her pretty well here, and they spoke highly of her. The Eastern Star have, and so I'm always finding a little bit more about Carrie and the wonderful woman that she is or was, and the Historical Society still honors that today, and we have a Good Neighbor Award. It's called the Carrie Engle Swanzee Good Neighbor Award, because she was such a good neighbor to everybody. And so every year we pick either one or two deserving people here in Keystone, and we honor them during the Holy Terror weekend with the Carrie Engle's Good Neighbor Award.
Well, it's everybody, I know it's a long ways out of the way, but I think everybody needs to come to Keystone. And we are out of time, but I wanted to just incredibly briefly mention, because I did not know this until I was at Keystone this year, but you are also the home of the Genuine Original Family Band. And
yes.
And if you've ever seen that Disney movie, or if you, during A Child of the 90s, watched on the pre-recorded Disney videotapes where they sang Disney and You, they used clips out of that, including the close-up of Goldie Hawn doing the high kick. So I think that's great, too, and hopefully we'll be able to talk about that in the next episode, and I hope that you'll be willing to join me again next year. And thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks, sir, and thanks so much for having me, and thank you for making that long trip out here. South Dakota I-90 can be very long and boring, so I am so glad that you made it, and I hope others can join us sometime and come out here. And we have a lot of history that no one knows about, because the Bauer family, also knew Carrie, they went to the same church, so yeah.
and really, there was a lot more. As we drove across South Dakota, we had to keep crossing out stuff because of time. But there really is a lot of stuff to stop at if you take the time to do it, though it is a long drive down I-90. So
yep.
Thank you for coming on, Jeannie, and I will hopefully hear from you again soon. And for everybody else, I want you to remember to brighten the corner where you are.